I have this friend. I had this friend in college named Jay. He was actually my roommate for a little while. And Jay was entirely deaf, completely deaf. His ears didn't work at all. It was really cool because he had this surgery when he was a kid that put these magnetic implants into the side of his head. And then his hearing aids had magnets on them, and so he could just like click them on, and then it would pick up the noise from his ears, which his ears didn't work, but it would like send it through the magnetic signal into his brain. It was like this fascinating thing. He had both of them, and he would do like party tricks. He'd like throw them in the air and catch it on the side of his head, and then one broke, so then he only had one. Jay was a smart guy. He wasn't always the wisest guy. And what I mean by that is one time we were at this cafe, and a couple tables down, Jay and his girlfriend were sitting there, and they looked like they were in this like heated argument. And he obviously did something wrong because she had like papers. It looked like she had printed out like charts and forms. And like, I was like, oh, Jay, you did something. And she was just giving it to him, and she was going and hand signals and raising her voice. And I watched Jay, who is just not enjoying the moment. And she's just like enveloped in her notes here and is just showing him how he's done something. And I watched him kind of start to move his hand up the side of his head, and then he grabs his hearing aid and he just pulls that down. He just holds it in his hand, and all of a sudden I see this grin just kind of come over his head as he nods and his eyes just glaze over, and I can tell he's going somewhere else right now. See, being smart is knowing how to use your built-in mute function on your girlfriend. Wisdom is not doing it. But Jay did have a moment of profound wisdom that really impacted my life. And we were roommates, and one day he came up to me and he said something. And at this time, I was competing in triathlons in college, and I was a pretty busy guy. I'd have to get up early in the morning and train for a couple hours, and then I'd go to school, and it was just like hours of school. And then I'd homework, and then I'd come home, and I would just be exhausted. So I'd just collapse in front of my laptop, and I would just watch The Office all night until I went to sleep. And Jay comes up to me one day and he goes, hey, Craig, I've been kind of like watching you for the last little bit. He's like, I've been noticing that every time you come home for like the last couple of weeks, you've just been just sitting in front of your computer playing video games and watching TV and whatever. And he goes, what's up with that? And inside of my head, I'm like, are you kidding me, man? I was like, I get up super early and like go work out for hours, and then I go to school and I'm like doing all this stuff. And I was like, it's not even your business, like what I do and how I spend my time. Like, why are you asking me these kinds of questions? But what I actually said was, yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm just really tired, and it's a good way to unwind, you know? It's just a nice way that I can come home and just relax and unwind. And then he says this to me. He says, Craig, someday you're going to have a job. You're going to have long days. You're going to come home to a wife who's had a long day. And maybe you'll have kids who are going to make your day even longer. And you'll have chores and taxes and all this stuff. And maybe you'll even serve at a church and you'll volunteer. And all this is going to make your day quite long. And every time you come home now tired and you go to that screen, you are training yourself to find rest there. And he says, what you're going to do is you're going to make it really hard for yourself, because one day you're going to come home and you're going to be tired. And there's going to be a temptation for you to go sit down in front of the TV instead of help your wife with her dishes. With the dishes, excuse me. Oops. If you see me sitting at a table someday with my wife with a bunch of papers out just giving it to me, you know, this is the moment. He says, you're training yourself, and it's going to be hard for you one day. You're going to make it harder for yourself, and there's going to be the temptation to not sit down with your kids and help them with their homework, and not sit down with your wife and help her through the stuff she's going through, and not go to the church and volunteer at that thing that you know you should be doing and you should be helping them with. And I think that was the day that I realized, it was this moment that I realized that I wasn't thinking about my future. I wasn't thinking about the fact that how I lived my life, the decisions that I made, was shaping who I was becoming and what my life was going to look like in the future. And even more than that, I don't think I was seeing that there's this bigger picture of my life and how the way that I lived my life was actually part of God's plan for how he shares his love and his hope to other people in this world. to be honest, I wasn't really thinking a lot about that stuff at that time because hope is really rooted in this idea of heaven and what's to come. And the more I thought about heaven at that point of my life, the less I wanted to go to it. See, I grew up kind of thinking that heaven was this place that when you died, there was like this angel express and you got the feathers and the wings and you and you go up into the clouds and then you just sit there and you eat Philadelphia cream cheese and you play harps and then everybody's like kneeling and just worshiping God for all of eternity. It was just like this one long, never-ending church service. And like, I love church. Like, I really do. I love church, but I've never been in a church service where I thought to myself, man, I want this to go on forever. And so for most of my childhood and even my teen life, I liked a lot of things about Christianity, but heaven was like the lesser of two bad options waiting for me after I died. And I thought I was alone in this. I thought nobody else felt this way because I'd go to church and people would be like, oh, heaven, it's going to be so great. And I was like, I can't imagine it. They're like, well, it's better than what you can't imagine. And I was like, okay. And then I was like, well, what do you imagine? They're like, I don't know, but it's better than that. And I was like, you're really not helping me here. And I just sat there thinking I was alone, that nobody else thought this way. So I did some research, and a 2005 study showed that of the people who believed in an afterlife, in a heaven, 80% of those people believed that it would be an eternal, it would be a spiritual place that we'd live out in eternity. There were no stats on whether or not there'd be cream cheese up there or not, but 80% of people believed that this was a spiritual eternity, that that's what we did. And the more I dug into it, the more I researched, the more I found that people had a lot of concerns, like what are we gonna do for all of eternity? And are we eating and who's there and how are we spending all of our time? I came across this one article titled 10 Reasons Why the Christian Heaven Would Actually Be Hell. And of their top reasons, they cited that there was no risk or opportunities for new and exciting experiences, that there were no more physical pleasures like eating, drinking, and sleeping, and that the whole thing sounds like one long, eternal church service. And as I read this article a couple nights ago, I thought to myself, wow, that is exactly how I felt when I was growing up. And that's why I think the promise that we're looking at today is so important, because like so many of us have gone through this or are actively going through this, and we're trying to figure out what is like the afterlife and what is all this stuff, and I don't know, and but no one wants to talk about it, and no one wants to preach on Revelation. And so I think there's a lot of us who sit in the same boat and who have struggled or who are struggling. And if you're new, Mark said a little bit earlier ago, we are kind of in the end of a sermon series right now called God's Promises. We're looking at the different promises that God has made throughout the Bible. Next week, Corn Roast is the last week of the sermon series, but because it's kind of Corn Roast, we're launching, this is kind of like our last Sunday. So I thought it'd be kind of cool to look at the last promise of the Bible. So we're going to be looking at Revelation 22, verse 7. If you have your Bibles, you can turn there. It's going to be up on the screen in a minute. But what's kind of going on here in Revelation is John, the guy who wrote this book of the Bible, is being given this vision or this dream, which is like a glimpse into the future. God is revealing to him this future, and he's got this little angel that's like guiding him through it and kind of helping explain. And every now and then, the angel speaks on behalf of God. He delivers a message that Jesus or God would have said. And so he's quoting the actual words. And so that's what we're looking at here. Revelation 22, verse 7, it's technically the angel speaking, but it's the words of Jesus. He says this, "Look, I am coming soon. Blessed is the one who keeps the words of the prophecy written in the scroll." Jesus says, "Look, I am coming soon." And if you actually look at the chapters before that, 21 and 22, there's this picture being painted. There's this description of this new kingdom coming down. God says he's going to, the old heavens, the old earth is going to pass away. He's going to create this new world in which he will come down, and there's going to be this new creation. And so this promise that Jesus is returning isn't just a promise that Jesus is coming back. It's also the promise that there is going to be a new creation, a new world that we are going to live in. See, as I grew up, I never really understood the difference between heaven and the new creation. I didn't even know about the new creation for most of my childhood life. So I always thought heaven, and then how does that fit in with this new creation? And even in Bible college, as I went and started studying and doing, you know, theology courses and reading all these books and all this stuff, people kind of had this way of phrasing the Bible. So they say, you know, you have your Old Testament, which is everything, you know, that's written a long time ago before Jesus came onto the earth. So it's all the Old Testament stuff, all the Jewish things. And then you have the time of Jesus, and that's his life, and he came down, and then he died on the cross. And then you have the New Testament, which is everything after. And this is like this. This is like the center of everything revolves around everything. The Old Testament is pointing forward to Jesus on the cross, and everything in the New Testament is pointing backwards to Jesus on the cross. And so this was this model that was given. And I think a lot of us read scripture this way, and we read into the Bible, and it's not wrong. It's not a bad thing at all. It certainly is true. Everything in the Old Testament is pointing forward, and the New Testament is just built squarely on Jesus, his life and his death and his resurrection. But the challenge that we need to be careful of when we read it that way is not to focus so much on what Jesus saved us from on the cross that we forget to look at what Jesus saves us to. See, it's not that the New Testament is just pointing at Jesus on the cross. It's also pointing to Jesus returning. See, another way to think about this is if the greatest moment that will ever happen in all of history, that will ever happen both past, present, and future, has already happened, then there's not a ton to look forward to. See, the Bible doesn't just point to the cross. As a matter of fact, if all it points to the cross, there's kind of this missing picture at the end. This missing thing. It points to the return of Jesus, and the return of Jesus is what gives everything purpose and value. It's what gives us hope. It's what makes everything have meaning. It's what fills the entire picture of our faith. Another way to think about it is Genesis 1 and 2 paint this picture of two kingdoms. The Jewish author talks about the heavens, and they use heaven for a bunch of different things, but heavens kind of meant like the stars and the cosmos and the sky, and then heaven meant like where the dwelling place of God was. So there's a heaven, this kingdom where God lives, and then earth, which is like the kingdom where man lives, right? So you have two kingdoms, and Genesis 1 and 2 paints this picture of both heaven and earth together, united, God and man living together. It doesn't take even three chapters before man messes that up. We rebel against God, we sin, and we separate these two kingdoms. And so God goes to live in the heavens, and heaven now, this kingdom is separated. It's out there where God dwells, and earth, this kingdom down here, is where we dwell, where mankind exists. And everything from the third chapter of Genesis onward has been the historical and the prophetic account of how God is carrying out his master plan to reunite the two kingdoms. Everything from that third chapter onwards has just been the whole story of how God is working to bring about the reunification of these two kingdoms so that God and man can live together again. See, it's not about us just going up to heaven and sitting on clouds and having a party. It's actually about God coming back down here to earth, creating a new kingdom in which we'll live real physical lives with friends, with family, in real physical bodies, with real physical creation. See, heaven isn't the goal for us. Heaven isn't like this thing that at the end of our faith, there lies heaven, and that's what we want, and that's where we're going to spend eternity. No, heaven is the spiritual waiting room for Jesus' return and for the new kingdom. Revelations 21, verses 1 to 4, paint a picture of this. They say, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and will be their God, and he will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away.'" chapter 22 goes on to say, then the angel showed me the river of water of life as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. The city. On each side of the river stood a tree of life bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. No longer will there be any curse, for the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in the city. There will be no separation between God and man. They will see his face and his name will be on their foreheads. There will be no more night, though they will not need the light of a lamp or the light of the sun, for the Lord God will give them light and they will reign forever and ever. Did anybody catch the part about how there's going to be food in heaven? See, when I was learning about all this, that one went really far for me because I feel the joy of the Lord when I snack. That's my spiritual gift. And it wasn't ever a problem until I came to Southridge because there's always food in the staff room. And every time there's an event, they bring it all up there. And now I have this reputation as the guy who just like cleans out the staff room's food. And so I just snack and snack and snack. And since kind of Southridge has been a bit of a problem, but it means a lot to me because I looked at this and I went, wow, it's going to be this physical, beautiful place. And when I was working at Sportcheck a little while ago, I had this reputation for being like the religious guy. And I was studying religions at school. And so people would come talk to me during my break and ask me different questions like, hey, I'm a Sikh. What do I believe? You know, have you studied that? Or like, what's this going to be like? And all these and things. It was amazing. Had a lot of great conversations. So one day this young guy comes in. And he's a vegetarian, and so he's asking me, you know, heaven, and what's it going to be like, and, you know, like, food and stuff like that. And so we're talking about it. And so he says, you know, is there going to be food? Like, are you guys going to kill animals and all that stuff? Because he's a vegetarian. And I was going, you know, it's going to be a physical place where we're going to have real bodies, and we're going to eat real food, but I don't think we're going to kill animals. I think, you know, the Bible talks a little bit about that. There'll be no more death. And he goes, wait a minute. Like, we're going to have physical bodies? And I'm like, oh boy, here comes the next question. And then he kind of looks at me and goes, you think we'll poop in heaven? I was like, oh, that's actually pretty mature of you to ask that. Because usually when I tell people that we're going to have physical bodies, they ask about a different physical activity in heaven. So anyways, all of that to say that the Bible paints this picture of this beautiful city, of this real physical world where we actually exist with other people in relationship, where we see God face to face. There's no more separation, where we exist within creation. There are trees. There's this created world. There are fruit. There's food. There's all these beautiful things. It's not like this spiritual clouded world. It's actually a physical place, much like I anticipate what we see outside today. With a couple major benefits, of course. Out of everything that we can know about what Scripture tells us about the new creation, possibly one of my favorite things about all of it is that there's going to be work. That's kind of like a weird thing to say. I get that. And I am a bit of a workaholic, but I perceive it's going to be like that. There's this quote by N.T. Wright. He says this, God's people will actually be running the new world on God's behalf. The idea of our participation in the new creation goes back to Genesis, when humans are supposed to be running the garden and looking after the animals. And I love that. When you look at Genesis chapter 2, verses 1 to 2, it says, thus the heavens and the earth were completed. This is the account of God creating for the first time, the first creation. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. I love those words, vast array. And by the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And then jumping forward to verse 15, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. Oh, I think I might come back on. Here we go. To work it and take care of it. I think that's such a cool picture of work. It's so different because it paints this picture first of what it looked like for God to be creative and to work. And out of, there was nothing, there was no need for him to do anything, but he decided out of the creativity of his persona to actually make something. And it was a vast array and it was beautiful and it was complex, but it was also so simple. And you can go down to the molecule or expand to the universe. And it just blows my mind and it's amazing. And what's more amazing amazing about all of that is that we are invited. We see that in the original account, the first creation, Adam was invited to partake in creation. He was invited to name the animals. He was invited to create and build things himself and tend to the garden. Could you imagine being like beside God, and he's like, "Hey, I've made all these beautiful animals, and they have like these complex like brain systems and like ganglia and cerebral synapses, and they have like your skeletal system, and you know, it's all these huge, amazing things going on with their body." And God's like, "Listen, I've done all of this amazing stuff, and I want you to name this animal." I just imagine what like Adam was doing at that moment. Just, I'm gonna call this one a dog. God's like, a dog? He's like, three letters? He's like, come on. No, that's fine. That's fine. I gave you this job. We'll do the next one. Here we go. Okay, next animal. And I was like, this one's a cat. I was like, okay, yeah, sure. But I just think it's such a beautiful picture of the opportunity we have to be in this world and to have these relationships with other people that grow infinitely, that we have this opportunity to know one another, to grow and be challenged and never stop, to know God and grow and be challenged, to explore the universe. That is a world that I could get excited about. I think one of the challenges, though, is not necessarily believing that this new creation exists. It's living as if this new creation exists. See, if we actually believe that this old earth is going to pass away and that God's going to come and bring about a new one, and everything that we've done here, we're not bringing with us. If we actually believe in that, then what does that mean for how we invest our time and our effort right now? If we actually believe that we can't take any of this, if we actually believe that God is coming and bringing this new world and that we want to populate it, we want to see the new creation full of people, then what does that mean for how we invest our time, our money, our energy, our sleep right now? I have a side business. We have like a media company, and we do photo, video, design, all that stuff. And so basically I have all these guys who are super talented on my team, and they do most of the creative work, and I just manage the projects. And so I go meet with clients, and you know, we do contracts, negotiate prices, and then I get the guys to go do all the work, and I just kind of manage the thing. And I face this tension, this question, what does it mean for how we invest our time and our effort right now? I face this temptation all the time. I struggle with it, because to invest in this kingdom instead of the next, to invest in the next kingdom instead of this one, sometimes requires me to make decisions that cost me investments in this kingdom. And sometimes I meet with clients and I know, you know, they work for churches or they're like a nonprofit or they're doing something, and I know I could charge them more than I do. And I want to charge them more than I do. And I know they would probably pay for it. And then I go home to the crew and I give them the projects, and I know I could probably pay them less than I do. And I could make more money doing it. I could invest in this kingdom. I could build more things for myself by doing it. And every single time I write up a contract, especially for a church, I walk away and I'm like, oh, I lowballed that. And I feel like an idiot, and I'm like, I struggle with this temptation to invest now here in this kingdom to build something for myself instead of investing in the next kingdom. I find it so hard not to get fixated on storing up treasures here and now in this kingdom. Matthew 6, verse 21 says this, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." I think sometimes we struggle to be excited for the new creation because we've spent so much time and effort and energy investing and building up things in this one. I think sometimes we actually are a little unnerved at the idea of a new kingdom coming because we've really done a good job of building into this kingdom. So my challenge for us here today, my challenge for myself every single day, is to find one place that we can just begin to intentionally invest in the coming kingdom. To find a place in your life That you can begin to shift the treasures of your heart, where your heart is pointing to, from this kingdom, from what you have here, into the next one. And I'm not saying having stuff here in this world is a bad thing at all. I'm just saying we need to start to find ways to invest, to intentionally invest in what's coming, to find our treasure stored up there, to find our heart rooted in that instead of being fixated on this one. I used to work at a warehouse when I was like just out of high school. And my buddy, he was kind of the only thing keeping me connected to church at the time. He would drive me every single day to work. He was the nicest dude. He would just sacrifice whatever it took to help anybody. And I totally took advantage of that. So he drove me every single day to work. And I always got stuck doing like the paperwork upstairs. But in the warehouse, him and a bunch of other guys would hang out. They'd have a lot of like discussions and they'd talk about stuff a lot. And there was this one dude who kept asking questions about like all the big stuff in life, like heaven and hell and why do bad things happen? And you know, is there an afterlife? All these big questions. And so this guy would talk to me about it often when we were driving home, and he was driving me home. And he was telling me, he's like, man, I feel like such an idiot. I feel like a failure. Because this guy is asking all these questions about Jesus and about faith and all these other gods. And he's like, and I just don't have the answers. And he's like, I think I have the answers. I go research it. I'm like, okay, I know it. And then I go meet with him, and I don't know what I'm saying, and it just comes out. It's a mess. And then there's this other guy who belongs to this different faith, and he just has all these amazing, really good, solid answers. And he's like, I feel like I'm just failing right now. I feel like I'm messing up hard. Kind of at the end of the summer, we're driving home one day, and he goes, I can't believe it. That guy that was searching for all these questions, he asked if he could come to church with me. So a couple days later, I was in the warehouse and I just chatted with this guy. I was like, hey, so what like made you want to go to church with that guy instead of the guy of the other faith, with my friend, instead of the guy the other faith who had all those great answers and you know could really talk about that? And he basically told me that even though my friend didn't have all the answers, and actually his answers kind of sucked, he was interested in what my friend believed in because of how he lived his life. He was interested in what my friend believed in because he saw something in my friend, a hope, a joy, a generosity that he wanted for himself. See, when we live out the values of the coming kingdom, when we live out what it's going to look like in heaven, when we're all in relationship, where there's love, there's generosity, there's faith, there's trust in one another, when we give freely and we have an abundant mindset, when we live out those values, we give people here on earth a glimpse of what's to come. We give people an idea of what we get to look forward to, why we have a hope. And here's the thing, we don't need to know all the answers. We don't need to know all the answers to all these complex questions. And I'm not saying don't go learn what you believe, absolutely do, but you don't need like a degree in theology. What you need is a heart that is rooted and set on Jesus and his promise that he is coming back and that there's going to be a new creation, a new world that we get to live in. See, we need to be intentionally storing up treasures in the next kingdom because where your treasures lie, there lies your heart also. Here's the thing, people are more interested in how you walk the walk than how you talk the talk. People are more interested in the way that you live your life, in the power that you have when you follow Jesus and when you live out those values and whatever you have to say. They're watching you. They're watching us. So my question is, where can you start to intentionally invest in the coming kingdom? Where can you start to root your heart in what Jesus is bringing instead of what we have here? Here's another way to think about it. What are the relationships you are intentionally investing in right now? And often when I think about, okay, what does it mean for me to do this? I think the best way is to think about who am I living out these kingdom values to? Even if it costs me something, even if it costs me to live out generosity when I make these contracts, even if it costs me building my little kingdom here now, who are the people that I'm investing in, that I'm building these relationships in and storing up treasures for the next kingdom, not this one? Here at Southridge, we intentionally invest in kids. And this is a huge thing for us. This is a massive value piece for us that we want to see our kids grow up one day to be living in this world, living out the values of generosity, of hope, of love, of service. And we want to see them filling up the next creation, the new creation. We want to see all of them there. And I think we actually do an amazing job of this. John works incredibly hard. We have a huge team of people. And we have so many kids here. When we do the kids' dismissal, it's like half the room just floods out. It's insane. And so we work really hard, but it costs us. It costs us money. It costs us time. It costs us resources. It costs us volunteers. And right now, we're in the summertime, but the summer's coming to an end, which means we're going back to two services. After Corn Roast, we're going to be returning to two services, which also means that we are going to need volunteers for Southridge Kids. There are so many of them, and every single one of their lives is worth investing in, but I want to encourage you to take a moment and think about if maybe the next step for you is to invest in these kids and their future. We have these pamphlets that we're going to have at the Welcome Center. John's mission statement for his kids. We want to encourage children to build authentic faith in Jesus by creating space for them to experience God each week and connect them into small groups with leaders who know them. With leaders who know them and love Jesus. I want to encourage you guys just to pray about that, just to take an opportunity to think about that. Go check out one of these. You don't have to take it home. You can if you want. We got a bunch of them at the Welcome Center. This might be the next step for you. Let me pray for you now as we close. Jesus, I have so much energy and time that I've invested into this world. It's so difficult for me to take my eyes off of it. I just pray, Lord, that you would share your vision, that you give me a glimpse of what's to come. Lord, I pray for every person in this room that you would give them a glimpse of what is to come, the coming world, the future kingdom. Lord, I pray that you would inspire them, that you would get them excited about that. Lord, that you would set their hearts on it. Jesus, I pray that we'd remember that people are watching us. They're watching how we live our lives. They're watching the values that we live by. And I pray that we'd be intentional to show people the values of the coming kingdom and point with our lives, point people to that. In your name, Jesus. Amen.